said to be in the constellation Virgo. That means they're located in front of that constellation along our line of sight. Mars will move into Virgo soon, and the planets Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto can be found nearby. This can be considered the beginning of the so-called lineup of the planets due to occur in the coming year. The actual event isn't a lineup in the sense of beads on a string, but the planets will be located in the same general area of the solar system in a configuration they return to every 179 years. In the last decade, there was a claim that this so-called lineup might indirectly cause a great earthquake in California. But without any evidence, that fear has been shown to be groundless. California will still have earthquakes, but not caused by the planets. Stardate is written by Deborah Bird, and we produce it for the University of Texas McDonald Observatory in Austin, Texas, zip 78712. And for the McDonald Observatory, I'm Joel Block.
Oh, yeah.
We're here.
They let us out of the pen again.
It's 12:07 a.m., and it's 10 degrees.
In Stony Brook.
50 Fahrenheit.
Good evening.
I'm Mike Uhas.
I'm Eric Corley.
And we're here...
until 3.
Sounds like you've got a terrible cold.
It does, doesn't it?
I don't know.
Am I supposed to sound that way?
Do you have a cold?
No, I don't.
Then you're not supposed to sound that way.
Oh.
Oh.
Too bad.
Well, we got a whole bunch of things lined up.
Yeah, yeah, we got all sorts of things.
We got all sorts of squeaking things in the background, like tapes and stuff that are squeaking around at low speeds. They'll get pretty annoying after a while.
We're going to have to do something about that.
No, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah, we can hit this little button.
No,
right
you cannot.
Okay, we can do something. But in any event, we will have a special guest about 12:30. How does that sound?
Sounds good. That's about another 22 minutes. Robert Christgau.
Man called Robert Christgau.
Oh.
Yeah. And he is, of course, a reviewer, a rock and roll reviewer.
And he writes for the Village
Voice.
Right.
That paper that imitates our name.
Right.
Oh, gosh,
it went down to 9 degrees already.
Hey.
Ooh.
That's symbolic of anything.
That's a sizable jump.
Now, if you'd like an album review read before we talk to this guy...
From his book.
Give us a call, and we'll do it for you.
Right. So you name an album, we'll look it up, and we'll read you the review. And then later on, we'll be taking listeners' questions and asking him.
Asking Robert Christgau himself, and he may even answer.
Perhaps.
We're lucky.
Sure.
We're made to stare at his phone.
We normally say, Eric, how was your week this week?
Well, my week was, it was interesting.
Yeah.
And I always say it the exact same way, too.
Yeah. So then it can't be all that interesting.
All my weeks are interesting, but they're interesting to the same level.
Are in a different extent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How was yours?
Very interesting.
Ooh.
I hear you guys saw somebody that looks just like me.
Well, that is true, Mike. In fact, we went to the city on Saturday.
Who's we? A whole bunch of people from the station, right?
Yes, a whole bunch of people from the station and from university at large. We all went into the city to look around the broadcast world in there. And quite a big world it is, even bigger than this place.
Oh, boy.
We saw somebody in NBC who looked exactly like Mike Uhas, from certain angles. I won't say he looked exactly like him all the time, but when he was standing facing straight at you, he looked exactly like you. When
really?
He turned to the side a little bit, something was different. When he laughed, it was exactly like you.
Really?
When he talked on the telephone, it was exactly like you. When he took a drink of water, though, it was totally different.
Really? What did he look like when he took a drink of water?
Not like you.
Oh, he didn't get any...
He looked more like Steve Kreitzer when he takes a drink of water, yeah.
Oh,
and
now, that's one of my problems. I have a drinking problem, as you know. I get it all over my face.
When he bent over to tie his shoelace, that was definitely more Norm Fruslin than Mike Uhas.
I thought you said he was wearing loafers.
No, I didn't say that.
Just testing you.
See? I'm up on things. But it was kind of scary seeing someone who looked exactly like you like that. I thought it was you at first. I was wondering what in the world you were doing there.
I would have wondered that myself.
I don't know what you
would
have done.
I was going to go with you guys, but something came up at the last minute. I ended up seeing a concert that night, and I couldn't...
Oh, well. Life's little tragedies.
Yeah, one of these folk-type concerts, you know.
Someone once told me they saw somebody who looked exactly like me.
Oh, no.
People say that now and then, but I always want to see these people that everyone says, yeah, it was exactly like you, or even talk like you.
Uh-oh.
I'd like to see that.
That's even worse news.
You never end up meeting your twins.
Mm-hmm.
You know? One thing I would like to do is meet somebody with the same name as
and
me.
I'd like to meet a Mike Uhas myself.
Yeah, who isn't related to you.
Not at all, yeah. I had a grandfather named Mike Uhas.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Well, we could do some investigating, look throughout the world. We tried to find the zoo last year. Last week.
Boy, you are in some kind of a time warp, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Well... You want to pick an album at random?
Van Morrison.
Okay.
Let's see. How about
Van Morrison.
St. Dominic's Preview?
St. Dominic's Preview. Do you like that album?
Yes, I do. In fact, we featured that as an album side one night.
Uh-huh. What do you like about that album?
I like all of it.
As he tries to find the page. Anything in particular that...
Man, it's just a lot
really...
of good tunes, man.
What's the name of the album again?
St. Dominic's Preview.
St. Dominic's Preview. Okay. Well, Jackie Wilson said it was Reet.
Great
Petite.
Album. Great album. A great tune, Jackie Wilson said. That's the name of a tune on there.
Oh. Okay, Jackie Wilson said it was Reet Petite, he shouts for openers, and soon has me believing that I'm in heaven when you smile. Says as much about the temporal and the eternal as anything in Yeats. Listen to the lion, he advises later, referring to that lovely, frightening beast inside each of us, and midway through the 11-minute cut, he lets the lion out, moaning and roaring and growling and stuttering in a scat extension that would do Leon Thomas proud. The point being that words, which on this album are as uneven as the tunes, sometimes say less than voices. Amen. And he gave it an A-.
A-?
Yep. So well, you picked a good album there.
Yeah. Does he have any Bruce Coburn in it? Well, he's not particularly
rocker. Yeah.
Well, when that book came out about a year or two ago, right?
Well, actually, it just came out now, but it's not updated all the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's dated just about two years ago.
If you can't find any Bruce Coburn, I'll settle for some Joan Armatrading.
Let me see. He might be up on Bruce Coburn.
Jimmy Cliff, I see.
No, he is not. He doesn't have anything on Bruce Coburn. But he does have Jimmy Cliff.
Yeah, a whole row of them there.
And he gave him a row of C's, in fact. Yeah, wow, he's got so many albums out.
How many do we have?
I don't think we have all of these.
Yeah.
Guess which album got the A?
Hard Do They Come.
Yeah, that was the one.
Yeah. That's a very interesting. We're using that word a lot tonight, aren't we?
It is interesting the way we're using it.
Yeah, but it's good in that, well, it's not really good. It's just intriguing that album features two cuts twice each on it.
That's true, and it still sells.
Are there any Joan Armatradings in there?
Joan Armatrading.
Yeah.
Picking all your favorite people, huh?
Yes, we are.
Joan Armatrading. I just passed by David Bowie. I'll come back to him in a second. Yes, there are Joan Armatrading albums here. Three albums.
Really? And what does he give them?
B, B plus, B plus.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I think he's up on that.
I'd probably give them all A pluses. And one more. Jesse Collignon. Well, he's the guy who I saw the other night, so I have to find out how he did. And
okay.
A.K.A. Youngbloods.
Yeah. It's Mighty Joe Young. Oh, no.
No?
I don't think he has any.
Oh.
A lot of Neil Youngs.
Yeah.
Heck of a lot of Neil Youngs.
Any Youngbloods?
Yeah, he does have a Youngbloods album called Ride the Wind. What do you think of that album?
I'm not really familiar with it.
Well, it got a D. What hath folk rock wrought? Or is it Marin County or owning your own label? A lot of third-hand Barney Kessel and or Dave Brubeck that couldn't have second billed at the Half Note in 1957. Country vibes don't mean various things that I can't say in the air. Occasionally this book lapses into things that you can't really talk about. Okay, let's look at David Bowie. Oh, I just passed by Dire Straits. I'm just curious what he does to them. You know what I'd like to do to them.
What would you like to do to them?
Well, I'll get into that later. All right, Dire Straits. He gave it an original grade of B+, but he raised it to B afterwards.
He raised it from B+ to B.
I mean, he lowered it. Oh, he did lower it. That's right, he did.
Why? Why did he lower?
Apparently, it didn't age well.
Oh, yeah.
And their second album got a B-. And he leads it off by saying, boy, people are getting bored with these guys fast. If they don't watch out, they're going to last about as long as Looking Glass or the Lemon Pipers. You remember those ones, Mike? Just another case of substance as novelty, I guess. Doesn't sound bad, but they'd better up those beats per minute. Interesting. Just about every album that came out in the 70s is here. Well, the important ones, that is. Or maybe I shouldn't say the important ones, the well-known ones. Because there are a lot of albums that haven't been released to many people that are very important. Don't you agree, Mike?
Absolutely.
Well, glad to hear that.
We just got a request.
We did.
Deep Purple.
Deep Purple. Okay, let's see what we got here. Anything in particular?
They weren't familiar with the name of the album, but we'll look to see all the Deep Purples that there are.
Did they know a song on the album?
Yeah, but I don't remember it at this point. Aren't I terrible?
Yes. Well, it's not too bad because there are only two on here.
Okay.
There's Machine Head.
Uh-huh.
Smoke on the Water is about a big fire in Montrose. Obviously, the most exciting thing to happen to these fellows since the London Symphony Orchestra. No jokes about who's getting burned, though. I approve of their speeding, and Richie Blackmore has cops some self-discipline, as well as a few suspicious-sounding licks from his buddies in London. Personal to Paul Kantner, check out Space Truckin'. I don't know who Paul Kantner is.
That's a strange name.
And he got a B. Mm-hmm. The album got a B. The other album they review is Burn. The hot poop is that after 10 albums, the Perps have a lead singer with soulish roots who can actually write songs.
Hmm.
Well, they got a C-plus for that effort.
Mm-hmm. And what would they get for the other one?
A B.
B. Good. Well, anyway, we invite our listeners once again, 246-7901,
to give us a call and call us up later on, too.
Yeah, we're going to be taking your requests for to check out the various... various records to be reviewed.
Sure.
And give us a call during Bunky and Spunky and or the next tune.
Good touch in public.
For the next few minutes, Radio Free Long Island will be taking you behind bars for a candid look at our nation's prisoners. Who are they? And why are they in jail? You may want to consider whether or not young children in your house should listen to this hard-hitting documentary. The place is the Amalgamated State Facility in New York. Approximately 2,000 prisoners are housed here for all kinds of brutal crimes. We went inside the main building to talk to a few of them. What is your name?
Frank Levinson.
And I'm from Croton on the Hudson.
And why are you here?
Well, I was just stupid, I guess. I went into a bank and, well, I suppose I just wasn't thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I made a small deposit and then, for no reason at all, I walked out to that little rubbed-off area they had that says entrance only.
Oh.
I knew something was wrong when the security guard started chasing me out the door. And that's when I made my second mistake.
Which was?
I pushed when I should have pulled. That's when they drew their guns, and I gave up without a struggle.
How long have you served?
5 years of a 25-to-life sentence. I should be eligible for parole in 1987.
Do you have any feelings of remorse for what you did?
All the time. I still have nightmares about it. I see myself walking right past that entrance-only sign and pushing on the pull door. I don't know what came over me. I tried to plead temporary insanity, but the jury didn't buy it.
That's a terrible story. Let's speak with another inmate at the Amalgamated State Facility. You are?
Jonathan Gibbons.
And where are you from?
Nowhere in particular. I'm a drifter. I go where I want. At least I used to.
Where were you picked up?
Over in Genesee County, up Rochester ways. Yeah, I pulled a good one.
Oh? What did you do?
Well, you know how when you go to the dentist, there's a sign that says, ring first, then enter?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did the opposite. I entered and then I rang the bell.
Ooh.
I mean, what the hell? I had a toothache, you know? Anyway, the dentist didn't say anything. He was just too scared, I think. I could very well have gotten away with this whole thing, except I have this one tragic flaw.
Oh?
Yeah. I like to brag.
Mm.
So later on that night, I ended up in this bar with a bunch of strangers. I must have had a few beers, because the next thing I know, I was boasting like crazy about what I did. I felt good about it, you know? And I thought I could trust these people.
And?
Well, I was wrong. I went into the bathroom for 2, maybe 3 minutes. And when I came out, the entire place was surrounded. The local cops, county police, state troopers, you name it. They were there.
But what went through your mind?
Well, I considered trying to make a run for it. But there were just too many of them. And so I finally agreed to surrender, but only if they agreed not to charge me with failure to wash hands upon leaving restroom. They could have gotten me for that, you know.
Oh.
And they agreed.
They dropped the charge?
Yes.
How long have you been here at the Amalgamated State Facility?
About 9 years. Now, my term will be up in another 20 or so.
Huh. If you had to live your life over again, would you change anything?
Nah, I don't think so. You see, I like doing what I did. It was fun. It really was. You don't know half the story. I took grocery carts out of parking lots. I pressed the alarm button on elevators. Once I called somebody on a payphone. Talked for over 20 minutes. And when it was finished, the operator wanted more money from me. Well... Ed, you know what I did?
I'm kind of afraid to ask.
I hung up.
Oh, my God.
And I just walked away in broad daylight. And nobody suspected a thing. Another time I was picking up the neighborhood newspaper. It costs a dime, and you're supposed to drop it into a little basket. Well, I only put in a penny.
Oh, you certainly are a hardened criminal. There's absolutely no hint of remorse in your voice.
I told you. I enjoyed it. And if they'd let me out, I'll probably do the same thing again.
So much for rehabilitation. Well, thank you for talking with us, sir. Let's move on. Well, we have about time to talk with one more inmate here at the Amalgamated State Facility. And, you, with your head between your hands. How would you like to talk with
us? Oh, what a fool I was. I thought I could do it. I really did. But they're too sharp. They're just too sharp.
And who are you, sir?
My name's Clyde Bullitt. I'm from Astoria.
Clyde Bullitt?
Yes, that's right.
Is that your real name?
That's my real name, and there's nothing funny about it either.
Well, it's just rather intriguing that a criminal should have such.
I know. I've heard it all before. Everyone here's got a great sense of humor.
Right.
Oh, what a fool.
What did you do to make you come up here?
I was in a hurry. I had to get to the other side of town.
And
there were no buses, so I walked. I was crossing off in Madison, and the don't walk sign was flashing. I really thought I could make it. I was about two steps away from the curb when it stopped flashing.
Oh?
Yeah, they were waiting for me on the corner. Seven cops and two police dogs. I didn't have a chance, so now I'm in solitary for 5 to 10.
Hmm. Do you have any plans for your stay?
No, not really. I was thinking of writing a book, you know, sort of explain why I did it, what went through my head and all that. But 5 years really isn't enough time to go into full detail. So I'm basically reading comic books and playing with this cube here.
And there you have it, the Amalgamated State Facility, home for 2,000 of the nation's most desperate criminals. We'll be right back.
It's now the time of the program where we venture out into the billions and billions of life forms on this giant spaceship. Earth. From this spaceship, we will take one sampling of life and examine it thoroughly. In depth. Where we will go and what we will find, nobody knows. But we can find out. And beware. Because sooner or later, we're going to get you. On the Voice of Long Island.
Well, this week, our special guest on the USB super duper tie lines and bylines and that kind of thing is Robert Christgau. Hello, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Well, Robert Christgau has just come out with a book called The Record Guide, Rock Albums of the 70s. Is this a new publication, or is it an update of an old one?
No, it's never existed as a book before. About 40% of it appeared in the Village Voice over the past 10 years in one form or another.
I see.
But it was collected and updated, and a lot of it is just completely new. I thought when I began that I had a lot more of a book than I turned out to have hidden in my past journalism. When I really looked at it closely, I saw I really had to do a lot of updating, so I did.
How long were you with The Voice?
I've been with The Voice since 1974, and as the music editor, and I started writing there in 69. I'm the music editor of The Voice at this very moment.
Whoa!
Did you ever write for Newsday?
Yes, I did, from 72 to 74.
I remember them.
Right. I left Newsday because they offered me the editor's job at The Voice, so I went back.
Ooh.
I like it much better, to be honest with you. I never felt entirely comfortable at Newsday.
Now, is the kind of music you review primarily rock and you don't branch out into, say, jazz or anything
well,
else?
Well, I'm anybody who paid close attention to popular music in the middle 70s branched out anywhere he could because what was going on in rock at that time, while it was certainly not true that there was nothing there, the pickings were kind of lean. I've always been a jazz fan. I've been a jazz fan for almost as long as I've been a rock and roll fan. And I actually started writing about it sometimes in the mid-70s. But none of that got into the book except for a few marginal things like Miles Davis and a Sonny Rollins record here and an Arthur Blythe record there that I thought really did qualify as rock if George Clinton did and Jimi Hendrix did. I write about folk music. I write about Soho electronic music. I write about blues. I write about country music a lot. I write about a little African music in the book as well. But for me, these are all like part of what I regard as my... I mean, they come out of my appreciation of rock, and I write about them in that context.
Mm-hmm.
I think anybody who was convinced in 1969 and 1970 that what was going on in rock was James Taylor, you really ought to listen to Tom T. Hall and Merle Haggard because they're twice as good as James Taylor.
Uh-huh.
For instance.
Yeah, we were playing some country, some western swang at the beginning of the program for a little while.
Yeah, we like to branch out into just about everything there is. Now, this book, there seems to be a cutoff date of, I'd say, a couple of years ago.
It's a book about the 70s. Begins January 1st, 1970, ends December 31st, 1979.
Oh, I see. Okay, so there's nothing from 1980 or 81.
Except there's a list. There's a list of the best, what I regard as the best album of the 80s, of 1980.
Oh.
But outside of that, there's no writing about it. I mean, I didn't write about London Calling because it didn't come out here till the 15th of January.
Ah, but you listed that as the best album of 1980, I believe.
Yeah, right. Great record. And it came out actually in the UK in 79. But this is it's about U.S. releases only.
Uh-huh.
Which means I had to leave out a few things that I really care about.
Yeah, well...
Few English albums and Jamaican albums. Actually, my favorite album of all time is the English version of The Clash.
The first one.
I never quite liked the American version as much because it wasn't as much of a piece, you know.
That's true. Is the English version is longer, I believe?
No, actually the American version is longer.
Oh.
But the English version was a record that was cut in, you know, 3 or 4 days when they were really in the first flush of discovering that they were the greatest band in the universe. And the songs all have a kind of anger about them. One thing that happens when you're writing about albums, you know, is that you have to think about them as albums. I mean, a collection of songs is fine. Most albums are collections of songs. Some albums are albums, and those are more satisfying to hear over the long run.
You mean it's sort of a theme?
Or it's just a mood, say. Not necessarily. I mean, I'm not talking concept album. I mean, that can be done, but it's usually botched.
Right.
I'm just talking about a kind of a emotional, sustaining emotional or intellectual feel to it. You know, that you get in a record like Van Morrison's Moon Dancer.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah, we were just talking about Van Morrison before we called you up.
It's interesting what you said about the concept albums, too, the ones that you know, botched. One you cited was Pink Floyd's The Wall. I couldn't agree with you more on that.
Right. Oh, well,
I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way. One thing I like, though, that you said about that first Clash album is...
By the way, Eric, why do you wear a Pink Floyd The Wall t-shirt all the time?
Because I got it.
Because I got it for free.
I got it for free, exactly.
Simple.
You know about those things. Well, you say the UK version of The Clash is the greatest rock and roll album ever manufactured anywhere, partly because its innocence is of a piece. It never stops snarling. It's always threatening to blow up in your face. I like that line.
Yeah, right. So do I. I mean, really, it's really a remarkable thing, you know, that record. And what's more remarkable about it, you know, is that the sound is, as everyone complains, the reason that Epic wouldn't bring it out here, you know, is that it didn't sound good enough. That's the reason they put all those singles, which were also great. I mean, they put White Man and Hammersmith Palais and Class City Rockers and a lot of other songs that I really love on the first side of the American version of that record because they sounded better and the AOR people would play them. You know, and they really couldn't play very well or anything. And it just doesn't matter at all.
Well, I don't know,
not
one,
at all.
One AOR station that played White Man and Hammersmith Palais. I'd like to find one, but there are very, very few. They get... So
oh yeah, what did they? What did they play? They played the cover version of the worst thing the Clash ever did. I Fought the Law.
Yeah.
The very well as before Sandinista.
What do you think of Sandinista? I wanted to ask you that.
Oh, I think it's got a lot of good stuff on it. I for some reason I haven't played it since February. I mean, when you own 10,000 albums or however many albums I own, and when they're coming in 50 a week, then to say you haven't played something since February is such a horrible thing to say. It really isn't. There's just too much to do with your ears.
That's
and
true.
Sometimes things just sort of get set aside and you forget about them. It's just inevitable. I mean, it's clearly not the kind of compelling record that any of the first three were, including the second one. The name of which has suddenly escaped me. What the hell is it called? The Clash.
Give Him Enough Rope.
I can remember this. What's the name of the second Clash album?
Give Him Enough Rope.
Of course.
Yeah, okay. when you listen to an album, how many times do you listen to it before you actually sit down and write the review?
Depends. 5-10 times, usually. And that doesn't mean that I sit there concentrating on it 5-10 times. It means I probably put both sides. My favorite side I've probably played 10 times, and the side I don't like so much I've played 6 times, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I've probably listened to it hard at least once. Or twice. I usually don't listen hard the first time. I mean, I like the music to sink in a little bit. And then when you listen hard, what kind of subconscious hold it has on you already, which is a real important thing in music.
That's true.
So 5-10 times.
I'd just like to butt in here and say at this point that you're tuned to WUSB, and we're interviewing Mr. Robert Christgau, music editor for the Village Voice, and we'd like to get an idea of, we'll open up the phones to the folks at home, and there's somebody here to answer the phone and take down your questions that we can ask you, if that's okay.
We won't do it direct. I'm going to have to have there's going to be a middleman reading me the questions, huh?
Yeah, for technical reasons.
We can't talk back to each other.
No, not...
And the folks at home, oh, it's too bad. That's what happens when you work with college radio.
Well, it so happens that our chief engineer just walked in, and he heard you say that, and... Yeah. But in any event, the number is area code 516-246-7901.
And speaking of radio, well, what are your views on radio today? Do you see it as...
I almost never listen to the radio.
Uh-huh.
So I don't have many views.
Well, you really don't have to listen to the radio.
No, I don't. Right. That's a flat statement of fact. If I were in the position that almost anybody else is in, I would have to listen to the radio, because how else would I find out what music there was? And if I were in that position, I'm sure I'd be listening to stations like your own. I'd be listening to FMU. I'd be listening to NYU. I'd be listening to the college stations. And I'd also be listening to BLS, which I actually think is easily the best commercial station in the New York area right now. Easily.
For what reason?
They play more good music. What's the reason ever? and they also, they're adventurous, and they have a real sense of mission about what they're doing.
How do you like their AM station?
I think it's fine, but it's not a music station.
Occasionally it is.
Really?
Occasionally they play reggae on WLIB, yes.
Not anymore. No, it's a talk. Where you been? It's a talk station. It's the black talk station. It's a great station.
Well, I listened to it over the summertime, and there was...
Did they play reggae that
Yeah, season? There was a gentleman called the Prime Minister there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know about that. Well,
it wasn't
good that they do it.
On the weekends, mostly.
I really like what they're doing with LIB, actually. I think it's wonderful. I don't know how long it's going to last, but I think it's a great thing. When 35% of the population of the city is black, and when most of the stations don't serve those people at all, especially news-wise, I think it's real important that somebody do it.
What do you see as the role of college radio?
College radio has become what we used to call progressive radio, hasn't it? I mean, it's what there is. And it's unfortunate that it usually has about 50 watts if it's lucky. So that it doesn't have the kind of spread and reach that you like radio to have. But on the other hand, it's really come up in the world. It's the only place where anybody who's interested in hearing the music can count on hearing it. That's not to say that stations like BCN and MMS in Cleveland, and even our own NEW, don't do some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't do enough. And for the most part, they... See, what's happened is that taste in popular music has really become so homogenized that it's like 1953 all over again. R.E.O. Speedwagon is like nothing so much as Doris Day. That's what it's like.
Write that one down.
The same kind of... The same sense of spiritual outreach, an adventure... Right? Has all that stuff.
But still, a difference from 1953, you didn't have any dictators in 1953 or anything. There was just so much that you can possibly find that's out today.
Well, yes, indeed. It's a very big difference. But I'm talking about what's on the charts, what the popular music is. Mm. Yeah, what I call, I mean, what I say in the introduction of my book is that where the action is in what I call semi-popular music, which is music which is based on popular forms but doesn't necessarily sell very much. Doesn't mean it doesn't sell. Often the good stuff, even today, does sell a fair amount. But, hell, a lot of it just doesn't sell at all. And that doesn't mean it isn't good. That's called aesthetics or criticism or something like that.
Yeah, that's true.
And the fact that rock and roll happened in 1954 and 5 is eventually what produced this enormous profusion of genres and independent record companies and audiences and markets, too. I mean, because what's interesting is that all these little record companies that now exist that put out records, almost none of which existed even 5 years ago, they manage to sort of keep their heads above water because they love what they're doing. They don't have big financial leads themselves. And because there are enough people out there to do the buying. I think in that kind of sense, it's actually a very healthy time in popular music. But I got into rock and roll because I was interested in mass culture and popular culture. I was interested in seeing the world change, and the world doesn't seem to be changing, at least not in any way that I like very much.
Uh-huh.
That's different.
Well, we had a request from one person that wanted to know what you thought of the Jim Carroll album.
That's kind of a hard question, actually. I was in the fortunate position of not having to decide last year, and so I finally decided that I wouldn't decide.
Oh.
Just put it away. I like People Who Died, and I think a lot of it is pretty good. I also think a lot of it is kind of sentimental and overblown. And finally, I don't trust him. What I do envision as a possibility is that he could prove to be very good, better than I think he is. Or better than I'm afraid he is, put it that way. And if that were the case, I bet I could go back to the first album and really enjoy it. But if, on the other hand, he gets worse, then I'll forget about the first album. I think it's one of those albums.
I see.
Is that an answer?
Yeah, no, that's not bad. What do you see as the future now for music as far as currently existing people?
Oh, you mean who's going to be the stars of tomorrow?
Not really the stars, but who's going to do the important things?
I have a lot of trouble with that question. People are always asking me that question. I find it especially difficult in terms of individuals. Right now, I think the most exciting rock band in America is probably X from Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually very encouraged by the hardcore movement, although, as near as I can tell, it's produced virtually no good music so far. Music that I really want to play a lot, a song here, a song there, but nothing album-worthy, nothing protracted. But still, as a tendency, I really like it. And I certainly think the vibes... I was at CBGB to see Bad Brains a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, they were here a couple of weeks ago, too.
Yeah, I don't know what it's like out there. I mean, it probably attracts a somewhat more specialized kind of crowd. One of the interesting things about the crowd at CBGB is that it was 60% your average Mohican leather boy, safety pin, dog collar recidivists, right? And that the other 40% was anybody. Could have been anybody. College boys, hippies, artists, blacks. Great. It was really great. I haven't felt anything like that at CB's in about 4 years. And I was very encouraged. I think Bad Brains is an interesting band.
Yeah.
Then halfway through the set, the music just sort of wound down for me, and I didn't listen anymore.
Yeah, we did a live broadcast with them, in fact, and we got some rather interesting comments about the music.
It pissed people off, was it?
You could say that.
Good. That's what they're trying to do.
That's what they're there for, I guess.
Yeah, I like to see that. So I'm encouraged by that. But you know what I really, you know, what I really think is happening right now is that there's going to be like a shakeout, and that we're going to find out who are the artists who really have something to say and who aren't. But that to guess who those are going to be is real hard. I mean, I have real faith in the first generation of CBGB people. All of them were really pretty great. Beyond that, there's really, I mean, it's just true. There's nobody I have this kind of absolute faith in. Certainly nothing from England, about which I'm very skeptical these days. I mean, I like the Gang of Four a lot, and I expect them to continue to do good work, but I wouldn't swear to that either, you know? I mean, if you'd asked me 3 years ago, I would have said, oh, X-ray specs. And in fact, I even like Polystyrene's solo album, but she seems to be pretty flaky, you know?
Yeah.
She had the right credentials. And I keep seeing people that have the right credentials, but that doesn't mean they're actually going to do it. Because it really takes a lot of persistence and kind of emotional, a lot of character. And that's a little hard to read the first time out.
Changing the subject just a little bit, a little while ago you mentioned that you did review a couple of folk-type albums and such in the book. Since I am basically a folk music fan myself, I really didn't have much of a chance to look at the book, could you give us an idea of some of your faves?
My favorite recent folk album is probably Cy Pond's Home, which came out on Flying Fish in 1979. You know that record?
I'm not too familiar with it, no.
I'm a big Peter Stample fan.
Uh-huh.
I like Michael Hurley a lot too.
And the whole Modal Rounders.
Yeah, that whole nexus of people.
Right.
I like Mary McCaslin quite a bit, although I don't think she's been doing real good work in the past year or two.
Oh, do you? Yeah,
yeah, but I like her a lot, most of her early stuff a lot, and I like Bramble and the Rose, but right. With Ringer on Philo in 78 a lot.
Yeah, right. One of the folks who one of the guys who does a traditional music program around here says basically about the same thing about her as you just did. He doesn't too much care for her recent stuff, but does like some of the earlier stuff.
Yeah, well, she really had that mountain feel, and then she tried to become a pop singer. She was always real great at interpreting pop stuff without losing that mountain feel. But
mm-hmm.
Recently, she seems to have lost it.
Did you get a chance to listen to Life and Time by her?
Yeah.
Then,
I think it was a very good record.
Well, there's one or two good cuts on there, I think.
The song was she originally recorded in 1969, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can't remember what it is. It's the first cut and the second side.
Uh-huh.
Each of the side openers I thought was real good, and then the record just sort of wound down. That happens a lot.
Do you have any other quick folk-type favorites? Or?
Well, I mean, no, because I don't have that many folk-type favorites. I mean, I like people who are come out of folk music. Bonnie Raitt, Joni Mitchell. I also like a lot of traditional black performers, much more the black performers than the white. I specifically don't like bluegrass very much at all.
Oh, no?
No. I think it's...
Just one more quick question, while we're somewhat on the folky kind of vein here. How about Bruce Coburn? How do you like him?
I put him in a section of the book called Subjects for Further Research.
Oh?
I find him a little on the literary side, in a pejorative way.
Yeah.
That way. I mean, I think he brings it off sometime, but even the great. I thought the greatest hits record that he put out last year was, I guess it was earlier this year, was a good solid B plus record.
Mm-hmm.
But it led me to believe that I hadn't been wrong to put the other records away till. Until I had the time, which is what I did with him. He does not turn me on very much.
Let us butt in for a second to remind the folks that if they want to ask Robert Criscal, the music editor of the Village Voice, any questions, we have time for a couple of more. 246-7901 is our phone number.
And we are WUSB Stony Brook. It's just about 1 o'clock.
And we have a question about reggae music. What do you think about reggae?
I think that Reggae is a music that was very hard for me to keep track of in the 70s. I think it was hard for almost anybody in America. You had to make it a specialty. You had to go down to Brooklyn. You had to waste a lot of money on a lot of bad records because it was very hard to tell what was good and what wasn't. I think that the quality of the reggae records that do get released in this country, most of which are released by Mango, is remarkably high. I think Mango probably has one of the best track records, just of sort of how many good against how many bad records of any label in the country. I really like the new Pablo Moses record, for instance. I'm also real interested in English reggae. I'm interested in Steel Pulse and UB40, which is what I find to be healthiest these days. I have real reservations about Rastafarianism and about what extent anybody what anybody can get out of it, especially if they don't live in Jamaica. In Jamaica, it makes a certain kind of sense to me. Elsewhere, it doesn't. And, I think it's really hideously sexist religion, for one thing. And that doesn't turn me on.
You mentioned Mongo Records.
Mango.
Yeah. Our own Lister Hugh and Lowe is a top executive with them. He comes in, he does a reggae show Saturday afternoons from 12 noon to 3. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Oh, well, Lister's a very important man in music in America, as far as I'm concerned. He's responsible for a lot of good music getting out.
Well, that's good to hear. And I don't mean to toot our own horn too much, but Lister tells us that when he played reggae on this station many years ago, we were officially the first station in the United States to even play reggae music, and that kind of surprises me, that there would not be anybody who would even play this stuff.
Well, also out on Long Island, you have old Epi at my father's place.
Yeah.
Who was a real loyalist, you know. He was bringing reggae acts into that club a long, long, long time ago.
That's true.
And deserves some credit for doing it. Because now what's happened is that is that the West Indian population has really gotten into the music so that it's profitable to bring them up here or over here, depending on where they come from. And you can pay the fare, and the bands make a little money, and so this is a wonderful city to see reggae, and everybody comes through eventually. It's really great. I mean, I saw Gregory Isaacs at the Savoy a few weeks ago. That was nice. And he's never going to be a superstar in America. I mean, I think that whole business of how reggae is going to break through, that people used to talk about, well, I mean, I think what Marley did was miraculous, and I'd be pretty surprised if it were to happen again, though I imagine Black Uhuru has some kind of a shot.
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed with the Red album.
Oh, that's a real good record.
Yeah.
Do you see any signs of reggae acts going, you know, commercial and almost top 40-ish?
Well, who?
Well, I'm just saying if reggae is becoming more popular, but I haven't really seen
it. No. On the contrary, it's just one of these genre music that's really found its market.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason to think the market isn't going to keep expanding. On the contrary, what happened is that they managed to get it out to the people who were its natural constituency. And then from there, a few people who just like music will also get into it, and that'll stop. It's not going to... I mean, what I'm saying is I don't think it's going to get big. That was a silly thought that people had in the middle 70s when they wanted things to be big. I mean, I see no reason to think that any of the stuff that we're listening to now that's good is going to get real big. Some of it might,
mm-hmm.
but there's no way of knowing what it's going to be or how it's going to happen. Or that it's going to survive with its qualities intact if it does.
But whether or not it becomes big, surely there's going to be some corporate executive in Madison Avenue who wants to try to make it big. And
But that's happened lots of times before. I mean, it's been happening since 1974. And A&M tried to do it with Dennis Brown earlier this year, and they flopped once again. They always do.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that's true.
Well, I'm just looking for any type of a band that's trying to make reggae, you know, a really popular type thing, and it's just doing totally commercial type of music. I haven't really seen that.
No,
in any
I don't
reggae
think it has happened, and I don't think it will happen. I really don't.
It's kind of inspiring to see that then.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I say, I mean, I think people begin to understand what the limits of these genres are. There's much less of this next big thing mentality than there was 5 years ago, and that's very healthy. It's not just true in reggae, it's true in every genre, including punk, new wave. You know, those people no longer think they're going to take over the world the way the Ramones did. The Ramones are very silly. I knew they weren't going to take over the world. I knew that, you know, it's just a matter of keeping your head above water, and if you can do that, that's good. Keep making the music, reaching your audience, and that's as much as you can expect to achieve. I mean, that may end, you know. I'd like to think that the world isn't going to stagnate forever, but it's not breaking up right now.
That's very interesting. A few more minutes left. I think there's somebody calling up right about now, but in case you want to try to get through, area code 516-246-7901. And we got somebody in the other room who'll write down your question and bring it in.
In a silver platter.
Well, it won't really be a silver platter. It'll be in his own two hands. But
symbolic.
It puts innocent people to work, at least.
We
are talking with Robert Christgau. I guess we should mention this from time to time. music critic from the Village Voice.
Music editor of the Village Voice. I'd like to ask you one question. How early in your life did you start really getting into music?
I really started getting into music before there was rock and roll.
Uh-huh.
In 1953, when I used to listen to Jack Lacey and WINS, listen to his Pop Countdown on WINS on Saturday afternoons. And then Alan Freed came to New York in 1954 and changed my life the way he did several hundred thousand other kids, at least. I've been into it ever since. I read Cashbox and Variety in 1955 when I was 13. A friend of mine subscribed. We used to pour over the charts and think about it. And I've really been... I went to college at Dartmouth from 58 to 62, and there was no radio. There was college radio up there. It was the football game. I listened to my jazz records and my Lead Belly records for 4 years. And then, but when I got back to New York in June of 62, there it was. I didn't need the Beatles for me to get back into it. I started listening to rock and roll again almost immediately.
Okay, it looks like we have a couple of more questions here.
Yeah, this one comes from Brendan from Smithtown. He's asking a question about radio, basically. When a song is played on the radio, does the artist get royalties? Would you know that?
He's asking me? Supposed to. The artist is supposed to get royalties. How this actually occurs has always been somewhat mysterious to me. I think it's done on some kind of strange mathematical principle that has nothing to do with the actual plays, I think. They think they read the plays. Isn't that right? You guys must know this.
Well, we don't.
Don't pay royalties because you're public?
Well, I know we pay something to, I believe it's ASCAP.
Yeah, right. I mean, you pay a fee, and then they have logs, but they don't log everything, right?
That's true.
So they just sort of guess.
That's exactly what they do. That's what the whole...
I think really just think that's the way it works. I mean, it's an educated guess. They're not making it up, but they clearly don't. They don't know the exact number of plays every song gets in every radio station in the country.
Well, I think that's good that they don't know exactly what that is.
I do, too.
Yeah. Okay, do we have...
No, it looks like our lines are dead now.
All right, well, I think we've covered enough ground for this time period.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I'd like to thank Mr. Christgau for joining us tonight.
Mind if I mention the book just one more time?
Sure, go right ahead.
Yes, the book is called Christgau's Record Guide. It's available in your local bookstores, and it's published by Tittner and Fields.
Great. Okay, we enjoyed glancing at it. We'll read it some more throughout the coming weeks and...
Sure, you can call me anytime you want.
Okay, great.
And it's always available for ready reference to any of our DJs here.
That's right. It's part of the USB library now.
And that's one of they're some of the most important people around here, I think.
Of course.
All righty. Well, very nice talking with you then.
I enjoyed it, too.
Good night.
So long.
Well, Robert Christgau, music editor of the Village Voice.
here on The Voice of Long Island. We didn't tell him the name of our program.
Gosh.
I guess we were afraid to.
Well, we could have told him it was Lister's Reggae Program. We could have told him just about anything.
That's true, we could have.
So, well, how did you like that little thing there?
I think he's an interesting person.
And what do we have coming up
but
now?
Of course, everybody is a critic.
Yeah,
you know?
But everybody's interesting in their own sort of way.
We'd like to hear any disagreements or agreements that people have with us, him, anyone.
No, just us or him. Forget about anybody else, because we don't want to know about the disagreements you're having with your neighbors about whose dog is pooping on whose lawn.
Well, it might be interesting, you know. Can be. Depends how you phrase it, I guess.
I guess you're absolutely right. Well, do you want to get into the theme now, or do you want to go into this record?
We could go into the record. We could do whatever we want.
Well, then
we have some things coming up. What time is it now?
I have 1:09.
We have the tripods coming up
within
this hour.
And 9 degrees.
9 degrees Celsius.
9 degrees C. Yeah.
In Stony Brook.
Yeah, the tripods are coming up. They won't be all that long for now.
And we have other things, other surprises.
We have a 5 o'clock album side coming up at 2 o'clock.
Do you want to try to get through to that operator in West Germany?
No.
Get yelled at?
Oh, the one that the other operator said was obnoxious? You want to do it now?
I just remembered that. Well, maybe it's too much telephone things now. We should give our phone a rest.
Yeah, I guess it is getting kind of warm, don't you think?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it's starting to smoke.
So, well, in the meantime, why don't we get into something from Tangerine Dream?
That's a good record. That's a good idea. Let me throw the record into the turntable.
Okay.
That's good.
Doctor, this is your recorded detail man speaking. What's new today? Something very important indeed, Doctor, and it's in the field of digestive enzyme supplementation. As you, of course, realize, there are numerous digestive difficulties that can be traced to quantitative or qualitative changes in digestive ferment production. Now, if such deficiencies are often intractable, Doctor, it is certainly not for the want of digestive enzyme preparations, because there are many of them available. The problem is rather one of supplying these enzymes in such a way as to ensure their individual protection and controlled liberation. Enzipan, the multivalent digestive enzyme compound, achieves just that. Enzipan contains first an outside layer of gastroactive enzymes which dissolves in the stomach. The acid-resistant core will then pass intact into the intestines to release its enteroactive constituents there. Embedded particle by particle in a special medium, these enzymes are liberated slowly and evenly over a large area of the intestinal canal. Hence, Enzipan has three major advantages. One, Enzipan contains in two well-segregated groups the gastroactive and the enteroactive enzymes, while other products act in one of these structures only. Two, Enzipan's enteroactive core is truly impregnable to gastric juices, while 33 to 50% failure may be expected with enteric-coated pills, as revealed in a recent study published in Gastroenterology. Three, Enzipan releases its enzymes slowly over a large intestinal area, not all at once, as is the case with so many other enzyme products. Together with bile, Enzipan supplies all the important digestive enzymes, hence its name, Enzipan. What are the clinical uses of Enzipan? First, of course, outright enzyme deficiency with subsequent fat, protein, or carbohydrate indigestion. Next, Enzipan is successfully used in today's vast class of dyspepsias of functional or nervous origin. Also, Enzipan will help to intensify and physiologically regulate digestion in flatulent or fermentative dyspepsias, postprandial fullness, or epigastric distress of ill-defined etiology. And it will prove beneficial in the digestive upsets of the hurry and hustle type, as well as in those gobblers whose eating habits, both quantitatively and qualitatively, cannot be controlled. Finally, Enzipan is a valuable aid in special diets, convalescence, and postoperatively in GI surgery. Now, a more personal word, Doctor. Coming to you under the guise of a phonograph record, I'm unable to reply to specific questions. However, if there are some doubtful points you'd like clarified, why not try the Enzipan sample on your next pertinent case? In this way, some of your questions may be answered more directly and more conclusively, too. Before you turn this record over, Doctor, may I thank you for the privilege of detailing you in the privacy of your home? I really hope you will enjoy the musical selection chosen for your pleasure and relaxation. This is your recorded detail man on this, my second visit to you. I hope I'm no longer a stranger. The last time I introduced Enzipan, the only multivalent digestive enzyme tablet to do away with unreliable enteric shell coating. Enzipan, the first and only high-potency digestive tablet with sustained enzyme release mechanism. Now, this time, I have for you another original development. Spasmacol, the specific treatment for spastic constipation. Not constipation alone, not spasm alone, but the spastic type constipation. 28 years ago, Norgine offered to the medical world the very first Bacillin bulk laxative ever produced. Today, Norgine laboratories are leading in constipation therapy by presenting Spasmacol, which reflects recognition of spastic constipation as a clinical entity distinctly different from and far more common than atonic constipation. Spasmacol unites Bacillin, the bland bulk producer with the highest swelling power among vegetable bulk substances, with bisgamma-phenylpropylethylamine, a non-narcotic spasmolytic related to and twice as active as papaverine. By its bulk, Spasmacol increases pressure, while by its spasmolytic agent, it relaxes segments to accept the pressure-elicited motions. Thus, peristalsis proceeds successfully beyond contracted areas, and specific relief from spastic constipation is obtained. Strictly a prescription item, Spasmacol bids fair to remove laxation from deplorable self-treatment back to ethical channels, right into the doctor's hands. One more good point. Spasmacol's spasmolytic body, in being a papaverine, not an atropine-related substance, is ultimately free from atropine by-effects. Indeed, so valuable an advance in spasmolysis does this chemical body represent that we incorporated it alone in a plain spasmolytic tablet, too. Plain, yes, but here's the twist. Since in smooth muscle spasmolysis, sustained effects are so highly desirable, we embedded half of it in the tablet's gastrosoluble, half in the enterosoluble segment. Remember Enzipan's construction? Thus, the first sustained action spasmolytic, Gamatran, came into being, which is my second presentation for today. Effective directly on the smooth muscle, Gamatran will relieve spasm, whether of neurogenic or myogenic origin. And through its timed release, Gamatran's spasmolytic effect is of longer duration and more stable intensity, A cardinal advantage, of course, in visceral spastic conditions such as peptic ulcer, spastic colitis, spastic urinary and biliary colic, certain vasospastic conditions, and dysmenorrhea.
I'm sorry, but your time is up.
Oh, thank you, nurse. In leaving, may I quickly state that a sample of each preparation is available by mailing the enclosed card. May I also suggest that you keep in mind our trio of products. Spasmacol, the ethical specific treatment for spastic constipation. Gamatran, the first sustained action spasmolytic. And, of course, Enzipan, the multivalent digestive enzyme tablet. Well, thank you, Doctor. I sincerely hope I'll be welcome again with a new message in the near future. Your recorded detail man.
Some 1940s type music. Eric, you just happened to walk right in right at the right time.
Yeah, I sort of beamed in, you know.
Stella Brooks and Greta Keller.
That's good stuff. It is.
We should have asked Christgau about that.
Yeah, I think he would have liked it.
Yeah, cover's good, but the music isn't. You missed the recorded detail, man.
I heard part of that as I was wandering around.
They were talking about spasmodic laxatives.
Yeah, that's something they don't talk about anymore, do they?
No, they don't. Not on air. This is a gift, well, a loan from Ray from Northport, who came up tonight and brought up a bunch of stuff, gave us the books.
Is it a color disc?
Yes, it's red.
It's red? And what year did that come out?
Late 30s.
So they're way ahead of their time, weren't they?
Yes. No picture discs, though.
No picture discs. That would have been something if you saw those.
This is interesting. Everyday ailments, consulting the specialists. Common cold. Here's the best one. This is what we're just listening to.
Okay.
Constipation.
I don't know if I want to hear this.
You know what it is? It says here, according to this book, difficulty in moving your bowels.
Is that so?
Irregularity alone does not mean a person is... this isn't really necessary, right? No. You don't think it's necessary. Do you have somewhere to go, or what are you...
For 1 minute.
Oh.
I have to get something that you're going to like.
Oh. Oh, I think I know what he's talking about. No, maybe I don't know what he's talking about. Actually, we got a bunch of mail in today. We occasionally get these things from the Navy. I have it in here. He's looking for... It's right here. It's right here. It's a book we got in. The book we got in just to... Ooh, there's that squeaky chair. It's
how did you do that
in today?
It went all the way in, then you have it in here.
Well, I didn't know, but in the meantime, we have a couple of these neat things from the Navy.
They sent it to me, you know.
Yeah, I know.
You take it.
For instance, Navy... Now, this one is good. Navy Aviation Storekeeper, First Class, Zbigniew J. Aleksandrowicz, son of George and Irina Aleksandrowicz of 336 Maple Avenue, Riverhead, New York, recently returned from an extended deployment to the Mediterranean Sea and the North Atlantic Ocean. Are you interested in this at all?
Yeah.
He's a crew member aboard the the aircraft carrier USS Forrestal, homeported in Mayport, Florida. During the 6 1/2 month cruise, he participated in various exercises with other units of the 6th Fleet and those of Allied nations, including the Ocean Venture 81. Let's see, another one. Something else here. Marine PFC Eric Uresk.
Ooh.
Son of Frank D. and Joan A. Uresk of Comac, New York, has been promoted to his present rank while serving with 2nd Assault Amphibian Battalion Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. He's a 1978 graduate of Comac High School.
How about that?
Yeah. Navy Ensign Douglas J. Geeb, son of Lieutenant Colonel and Mrs. Philip G. Geeb of West Hampton Beach, has completed the non-lawyer course at the Naval... What are you laughing about?
Oh, I'm not laughing at anything.
At the Naval Justice School in Newport, Rhode Island.
Are these ones that you threw at me once you've read already?
You know, I haven't read them yet.
Well, in that case, Marine PFCA, what does PFC stand for?
Was it stand for Private First Class or something?
Private something or other. Edward T. Bly, son of Edward T. Bly.
I can't wait till he becomes a captain.
On 16 Dorchester Street, South Huntington. It says South, Huntington, but I think it means South Huntington,
mm-hmm.
Dorchester Street South, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In Huntington, New York, has reported for duty with the Headquarters and Maintenance Squadron 39 Marine Corps Base, Camp Pendleton, California. He joined the Marine Corps in May 1980, and we'll update it as it comes in.
Navy Aviation Machinist Mate 3rd Class, Sean P. Lane, son of Mr. and Mrs. Thomas J. Lane of 341 O'Connor Road, not Lane,
ooh,
of North Babylon, has returned from a deployment to the Mediterranean and North Atlantic. Check that out.
You know, we are expecting a bunch of press releases on all the new students for next year at Stony Brook.
Oh.
And their hopes and ambitions. And also, we have one that we should be getting next week on all the people who have dropped out of Stony Brook and why they've done it, what they're doing now, that type of thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
You know, it's public interest.
It is. Navy Aviation Electronics Technician 3rd Class Kenny M. Kobus, son of Robert J. and Mary T. Kobus of Mauritius, New York, has returned from a deployment to the Mediterranean North Atlantic. And so you want to get into what you have there,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, I have a book here.
A book that...
Turn my mic back on. That's not funny. Well, this book we got today by a gentleman called Randy Cohen, and
that's a made-up name if I ever heard of
it. I guess so, but we will be speaking with this person, I'm pretty certain, in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I think this guy is amazing.
He's tough.
And you do, too, because you told me so. The book is called Modest Proposals, The Official Correspondence of Randy Cohen. And what it is, it's really something. This company that he supposedly made up, Manhattan Applied Research Division, he has the letterhead of that all over the place, and letters addressed to various people all over the place and corporations and things, making these unbelievable proposals.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, he got answers from them.
Yes.
And you see the letterhead of all sorts of other big important places.
The Postmaster General.
Department of Transportation, U.S. Department of Labor.
The White House.
Now, let me read one example, and maybe you can read one example or two.
Yes.
Examples or whatever. This is to the post office, to William F. Bulger, Postmaster General, U.S. Postal Service, 475 L'Enfant Plaza, West Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20260.
Well, that's important to know. What is the 9 digit?
They don't have that here. April 25th, 1980 is the date of the letter. Dear General Bulger... What is the nine digits?
They don't have that here. April 25th, 1980 is the date of the letter. Dear General Bulger, I don't really know how to say it. We can find out later.
They call him General, huh?
Yeah, they do. Postmaster General. You certainly are getting a lot of criticism for suggesting an increase in postal rates and the possible elimination of Saturday delivery. However, I believe I have a way to save the 15-cent stamp. Why not deliver the mail only on Saturday? Let's face it, people get very few things that they must have by Thursday. To be honest, what difference does it make if your letter comes on Tuesday? If people can get used to going to church only once a week, well, then they can get used to once a week mail delivery. What's more important, junk mail or the Lord? You can use that slogan if you want to. If that doesn't save enough money to save the 15-cent stamp, I propose that you go to once-a-month delivery. People would still get their checks and bills, their magazines and ads, their personal letters and odds and ends in due time. You could call the delivery day mail day, and it could be a monthly holiday. There would be celebrations and parties and fiestas in Hispanic neighborhoods. Receiving all your mail on one day each month would certainly produce a sense of occasion. People would love it. Remember that Joe Stafford song from 1951, "Shrimp Boats Are Coming, There's Dancing Tonight." You could produce a record called "Mail Trucks Are Coming, There's Reading Tonight." That would help everyone get used to the idea. Each of these plans would save money and promote efficiency and high productivity. Remember that President Carter said that we Americans may have to get used to a lower standard of living. Well, the Postal Service could take the lead in lowering our standards. We must all decline together. I'm doing my bit by wearing old clothes, eating worse, and eliminating every other haircut. I'm quite interested in learning your reaction to these ideas. I look forward to hearing from you. Yours, Randy Cohen.
And the reply?
On the next page, from the Postmaster General, dated May 7th, 1980. Dear Mr. Cohen, I appreciate the cleverness of your letter. It was witty. It was creative. It was of no earthly use to me except for the laugh. We must all decline together, you said. I decline that invitation. Thank you. Sincerely, William F. Bulger.
Yeah,
your turn.
One that I found a little earlier. Here it is. This is to David L. Unick, who was then the chairman and chief executive officer of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, in a letter dated August 5, 1977. Dear Chairman Unick, as a frequent passenger on the subways, I am disturbed, as I am sure you are, by the continuous erosion of the quality of service your agency is able to provide. Realizing that you are faced with a decline in the number of riders and resulting decline in revenues, I would like to offer a suggestion that could attract more users to the trains. Might you not experiment with the addition of a bar car to certain lines? Since the average trip on the subways is a brief run, the drinks provided at this bar should be very small, perhaps sold in miniature souffle cups, like the kind in which coleslaw is served in delicatessens. If this project proves to be a success, there are myriad possibilities for expansion. The menu might come to include various small foods, perhaps beginning with cocktail franks served in tiny buns. Ultimately, entertainment might be added in the form of small musical ensembles, and none larger than a trio. Not only would the bar car attract more riders, but since the drinks could be sold at a profit, it would become an additional source of revenue. This new source of funds might one day enable you to complete the Second Avenue subway. However, aside from any potential profits, the bar car would offer intangible benefits by making a trip on the subway far more pleasant, a goal to which, I'm sure, we both subscribe. Sincerely, Randy Cohen.
And the reply?
And the reply. Dear Mr. Cohen, Chairman Harold L. Fisher, they changed chairman in the month since the reply, asked me to reply to your letter of August 5th about installing a bar car and other such amenities in subway trains. The Transit Authority always appreciates helpful suggestions from the public, particularly when they will help make a ride safer or more comfortable for our passengers. Your suggestions about drinks and miniature cups, special menus, and musical entertainment are certainly unusual. However, we do not feel they are practical. Nevertheless, we will make your suggestions available to officials of the authority. Thank you for taking the time to write us. Sincerely yours, F.J. Goldsmith, Jr., Director, Correspondence Bureau. I'd just like to mention something here. This fellow, Randy Cohen, has a bunch of letters in this new book that
he
from St. Martin's Press.
It reminds me so much of a book which came out a few years ago called The Laszlo Letters. Have you ever heard of that
book?
No,
I never did.
It's a very similar in vein, rather irreverent about this fellow writing to all these corporations and such with these wild suggestions. Uh-huh. But this is a different fellow, Randy Cohen.
That's true.
Yeah.
It is a different person. All right. We have one more letter that we're going to read from Manhattan Applied Research Division, Randy Cohen, to the Public Relations Director at McDonald's in Oak Brook, Illinois.
You know, that's very interesting because this other book that I was telling you about, they wrote to him as well.
Did they?
They asked about serving ketchup with egg muffins.
Uh-huh. All right, let's see how this one does. To the director, I've read that you've met a lot of local opposition, petitions, demonstrations, formal protests, to your plan to build a new McDonald's in the London neighborhood of Hampstead, just up the hill from the garden where John Keats wrote Ode to a Nightingale. I was certainly surprised by the uproar. Who'd have thought people would prefer poetry to hamburgers? But there you are. However, I believe I have a solution to your problems. You should tailor the design and menu of the new shop to suit the local customs and culture. Perhaps you could go ahead and celebrate the local hero by naming the new McDonald's in his honor. Call it Keats Eats.
Oh, my God.
You could serve Hyperion hamburgers, La Belle fries sans merci and avec salt, and milkshakes in the replica of a Grecian urn.
How much does a Grecian urn, by the way?
It's a bit more expensive than a milkshake, I think.
Oh, I see.
Your slogan could be, "You deserve an ode today."
Oh, boy.
In fact, I suspect that this could be a hot marketing concept for all the McDonald's in the British Isles. Let your chain celebrate all the romantic poets. You could open up Percy Bysshe Burgers.
Percy Bysshe Burgers?
Bysshe Burgers, or just call it Shelley's Place, Byron Burgers, McWordsworth's, or the Coleridge Cafe. I'm eager to learn your reaction to this plan. I'd be glad to provide further details or to delineate a similar approach for the romantic poets of other lands. What do you say to Gothburgers or McWhitman's? I look forward to hearing from you. Yours, Randy Cohen.
The reply?
The reply came in October. The letter was written in August. And, yes, it came right from Oak Brook, Illinois. Thank you, Mr. Cohen, it starts off, for writing to us concerning your idea. We try to gear our external and internal restaurant decor to the theme of the community. One reason our service is able to be consistently speedy is that the customer knows what will be served at a McDonald's restaurant at each visit. The menu is always familiar to the customer. This concept would not be possible if your concept were to be used. Although we are not interested in your idea, Mr. Cohen, we certainly do appreciate your thinking of McDonald's. Again, thank you for writing to us. Sincerely, Diane Klecka, Manager, Consumer Affairs.
Huh.
And there you have it.
Gosh. Well, we've got a whole bunch of things coming up. We've got the Adventures of the Tripods. We have
the Exciting Adventures of the Tripods.
We have our 6 o'clock album site at 2 o'clock. And,
did he do? The news at 1:55?
Hey, exactly.
All sorts of things to look forward to here in the Voice.
The Voice of?
Long Island.
Where are we? We're at WUSB.
Stony.
Brook.
New York.
90.1
FM.
Yeah, the Tripod Family. You heard of them? Yeah, they'd be coming up real soon.
Ready! The night away. Come on! Come on, let's reggae! Reggae!
Radio Free Long Island, in affiliation with the Three Village Tobacco Farms, proudly presents the exciting adventures of the Tripod Family, the story of one of America's most illustrious families and their struggle to find peace and happiness in the suburbs of Long Island. As we look in on Kathy and Howard today, they are still in the tunnel system of Nice, and they're still looking for the statue with their friend Boris. As we look in, we hear them say...
There's so much mud and slime and things around us, Howard.
Yeah, well, at least we can see where we're going with these fluorescent lights. Incidentally, Boris, how come there are light switches down here in the sewers of Nice?
Well, it was a bureaucratic mix-up, Mr. Tripod.
Oh?
The sewer system got a complete electrical system, and City Hall got an assortment of manhole covers.
Is that so?
Yeah.
You know, there sure are a lot of stories connected to this place. It's amazing I never knew about this entire sewer system until now.
Be careful, Mr. Tripod. It is particularly slimy where you are now standing.
Oh, yes.
Watch your step. Yes, there is quite a history to the sewer system. Some good and some not so good.
What do you mean by that?
Ooh! Howard, did you hear that?
Yes. Yes, I did, Kathy. I wonder what that was.
Come. We must be off to search for the hidden statue.
Right, right. That is what we're here for, after all.
Yes.
But what was that you were saying before, Boris, about the bad part of the sewer system's history?
Oh, it's nothing for you to trouble yourself over, Mr. Tripod.
But even so, Boris, I'd still like to know.
We Tripods are on a continual quest for knowledge, you know.
Exactly. Now, I'm not going to go crazy over some silly story. I just want to know the facts.
Well... If you are certain that you will not act like a baby, I will tell you.
Oh, please, do.
It is said that many years ago, when the sewer system was first constructed, a small cemetery had to be destroyed to allow the work to continue. Many of the workmen were reluctant to proceed, but the sewers were built nonetheless.
Interesting story. Well, that wasn't too bad, was it?
Wait. There is more.
Oh?
According to this account, every man who helped build these sewer systems died a sudden and violent death inside the sewers themselves.
That is remarkable, isn't it, Kathy?
Wait! There is more.
Oh, boy.
When the sewers were finally completed, something very mysterious happened. Outside each and every entrance, a sign appeared which read, "All who enter here are doomed." And to this day, nobody has been able to take down those signs.
Now, wait a minute. Now, we entered the sewers a little while ago, and I didn't see any sign like that. Did you, Kathy?
No, I didn't see anything quite so ominous, Howard.
So I really can't take much faith in a silly ghost story like that, Boris.
There was a sign, Mr. Tripod. I carefully stood in front of it so that you would not read it and perhaps chicken out.
Oh. Oh, well, even so, I still don't see any need to believe silly stories. Do you, Kathy?
Oh, of course not.
Listen. There it is again.
Oh, it's only the wind, Howard. It's only the wind.
Of course. That's all it is. What is it, Boris?
Well, according to my calculations, we should be right underneath Wally Chewbird Street right now.
So that means?
That means the treasure is near.
Where should we be looking?
Well, you can look on the ground. See if you see anything peculiar. I'll look up towards the ceiling.
Okay. Kathy, are you going to help me?
Oh, of course. At last, the moment we've all been waiting for. I can hardly wait to see Charlie's face when he sees us bringing home that statue.
Well, let's not get too enthusiastic, Kathy. We haven't found it yet. Well, I just hope we can get out of this place as easy as we... Now, I don't care what anybody says. That was not the wind.
And so the tripods get deeper and deeper into the Nice sewer system. Will they ever get out? And if so, will they ever find the statue? You want to be with us next time when we'll hear Pop say,
"Hey, whatever happened to me?"
That's next week on the exciting adventures of the Tripod Family, a presentation of Radio Free Long Island and the Three Village Tobacco Farms. This is Don Topeka.
I can tell by that doorknob, that door slamming, it must be time for the news.
Yes, that was an official door opening and closing.
Mm-hmm.
What was it we were listening to? That's very nice.
That's, this is a new album we have in, called Women's Orchestral Works, performed by the New England Women's Symphony, Kay Gardner, musical director, conducted by Antonio Brico, Miriam Bartweb, Kay Gardner, and Jean Lemon. And what are we listening to?
I like it, whatever it is.
It's Symphonie by Maria Grimani, conducted by Jean Lamont.
So it's female all the way around.
Yeah, it was written in 1713.
They don't write music like that anymore for some reason.
They don't. They don't. Well, anyway, it is 1:56 and time now for a look at the one... Can you keep that open?
Thank you.
The 1:55 news. Technically, the federal government has run out of money, and there will be no more action on a measure to refill the coffers until morning. House and Senate conferees have recessed for the night in their efforts to pass a stopgap spending measure for the federal government. They failed to reach agreement by midnight when an earlier funding measure expired.
Excuse me, Mike. Some people might think it's crass to read news over classical music.
Oh, I guess you're right.
Yeah, that's better.
The lawmakers will be back at work at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Republican Senator Mark Hatfield of Oregon, one of the conferees, says there are two main issues still to decide, the amount of cuts in each category and the length of time the stopgap measure will be in effect. Before adjoining, the conferees took the unusual action of recommending a 4.8% pay raise for House members, but no salary increase for senators. It's a provision that's expected to spark opposition when it comes up for a vote in the Senate. At the White House, meanwhile, a spokesman says the administration is left with no choice but to initiate government shutdown procedures. Now that there's no money left to run the government. But the spokesman could not name which parts of the government would be affected by the failure to pass a stopgap spending bill. Eric?
Well, a Japanese journalist has told the Associated Press that she gave U.S. National Security Advisor Richard Allen a watch last January to thank him for arranging an interview with Nancy Reagan. The journalist says Allen also received another watch from one of her co-workers. The Justice Department has been looking into Allen's receipt of $1,000 from the Japanese magazine that interviewed Mrs. Reagan. Allen placed the money in the White House safe, but the Japanese writer says she expected Allen to put it into the First Lady's charity program. Can you keep that open, please?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So are we set on the news?
I think so.
Are you done?
Soviet officials in Washington have revealed that 6 months ago, an invitation was extended to President Reagan to hold a summit with Soviet President Brezhnev. Officials say the suggestion that the two leaders discuss their differences came in a letter from Brezhnev last May. A White House official, asking that his name not be disclosed, says Reagan would be interested in such a meeting, but only at the proper time. Well, there were no injuries Friday night in a bomb explosion outside the Turkish embassy in Beverly Hills, California, but police say the blast did cause heavy damage as doors were blown off and others buckled. Callers to the Associated Press said Armenian nationalists were responsible. They threatened that the bomb was only a warning to the Turkish government.
Armenian nationalists?
Yeah, Armenian nationalists are seeking revenge for the Turkish massacre in 1915 of Armenians seeking independence from Turkey. How did you know that said Armenian nationalists?
Because you said so.
Oh, yeah, but the first... Okay, that's a very strange coincidence there. Oh, Pennsylvania has been dealt a... All right, keep it closed. I don't care. Hi, Joanne. Pennsylvania has been dealt a blow to its plans for reducing benefits to 110,000 welfare recipients on December 1st. A federal judge in Philadelphia ruled Friday that the state could not cut the benefits as a result of Reagan administration budget cuts. A U.S. attorney says he expects an appellate court to make a decision Monday on whether to stay the ruling. Mike?
I'd always wondered what an appellate court was. Was it the kind of ammunition you use in those pellet guns?
No comment.
Well, in any event, it be just about 2 o'clock. You're tuned to WUSB Stony Brook. I'm Mike Uhas. Eric Corley's in the other studio.
Here I am. Yes, I'm over here. I'm over here with all sorts of other crazy things going on.
Uh-huh.
Anything's possible.
Yeah. In any event, we're at that point in the program to get into our album side, the 7 o'clock album side at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I thought it was the 6 o'clock album side.
No, it was 4 o'clock the first.
Oh.
But 5 o'clock, excuse me. In any event, we picked out an album tonight By an artist that Robert Christgau happened to have mentioned during his interview with us, our interview with him. It's an album by Bonnie Raitt, one of my favorite Bonnie Raitt LPs.
Uh-huh.
He gives it an A minus. It's called Taking My Time, came out in 1973.
Sorry.
Came out in about 1973. Should I read the review?
For those interested, that was a reed organ.
Oh. I thought you read with your eyes.
And for all those who are interested, this is a Silent Night music box. Coming up.
Shows you how silent it is. This is silence. I hear, let me see.
True.
Okay, now, I'm going to just, like, turn this down a little bit, and I'm going to just, like, ask you to just remain silent.
Okay.
I hear people asking when Bonnie is going to do something new, but conveying songs from Calypso Rose and Martha Reeves Vandella into the women's music of the 70s is new enough for me. I must admit, though, that neither statement is enhanced by association with the folkies whose ballads she favors. Too pretty, too ordinary. Anyway, this album he gives an A minus to.
What do you give it, Mike?
I give it an A. A minus, yeah. I agree with it.
You agree?
Yeah, I agree. The best part of this album is that it was photographed in the Los Angeles Union Passenger Terminal. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, same place that a Tom Scott LP was photographed.
Which was first?
I'm not sure. The chicken or the egg? I'm not sure. In any event, we're going to hear side two, all of side two, where the songs are Washi Go Do, I Feel the Same, I Thought I Was a Child, Write Me a Few of Your Lines, Kokomo Blues, and Guilty.
What was that first song again?
Washi Go Do.
That's what I thought it was.
Yeah. So, without any further ado, in case you'd like to reach us, the telephone number here is
516-2-4-6-7-9-0-1.
And,
you want to say that in English so that people might really call us?
No, there's nobody listening anyway.
Well, I'll give it one more time.
516-246-7901.
Every night. Thank you. I got some whiskey from a bar. Got some cocaine from a friend that I had to keep on moving, baby, till I was back in your.
Bonnie Raitt here on USB, the voice of Long Island. That song's called Guilty, written by Randy Newman.
I've heard of him.
Yeah, before that we heard Write Me a Few of Your Lines, Kokomo Blues. Also, I Thought I Was a Child, written by Jackson Brown. I Feel the Same, and Washy Go Do.
Washy Go Do.
Up on top.
Washy Go Do.
The voice of Long Island, album side of the night.
And we did get a telephone call from Walt Scratch saying he wasn't listening.
That's good. It's good that people not listen, you know?
Yeah.
It's healthy. Not listening in Port Jefferson.
Right.
Well, you have another letter.
I did. Let's see if I can find it. Yes. This is a letter.
From?
From Randy Cohen.
Randy Cohen.
And it is to Ray Marshall, Secretary of Labor. Dear Secretary Marshall, I'm writing to you because your agency handles complaints of sexual harassment in the workplace, a serious problem and the sort of abuse no worker should have to endure. My own problem, however, is an odd variation on this issue, and I'm not sure where to turn. I hope you can be of some assistance. Lately, I've had to confront professional harassment in the sex place. I've been in what I thought were purely sexual situations, only to have work dragged into it. Perhaps the two of us are lounging around in the morning,
suddenly I'm being hit on for a promotion, if the other is my professional inferior. If I'm with a professional superior, I might be pressured to do extra work at home. It does little good to limit my social life to those who are employed elsewhere. They sooner or later propose some sort of deal, which, while we're in bed. I say this is unfair. We'd formed a strictly sexual agreement. Where does the other get off dragging? Where does the other get off dragging work into our bed? On the other hand, I fear that if I decline these professional propositions, I'll be denied an opportunity for sexual advancement and joy. What am I to do? There is no sexual protection agency. My union claims to have no jurisdiction here, and I don't know where else I'm going to turn. I'm a human being, and I'm entitled to a sex life without these sorts of professional pressures being applied. Can your agency provide any help, or can you suggest what other agency could help? At any rate, I'd like to know if other workers have made similar complaints to you. It would mean something just knowing I'm not alone in this crisis. Please advise. And Randy Cohen.
What was the answer?
Dear Mr. Cohen, I am responding to your letter of January 7th, 1980, addressed to Secretary Marshall. This is very interesting. It was this letter's reply was dated January 10th. Yours is the first complaint of this nature we have received. You have rightly concluded that no federal agency has an interest in the situations you describe. My only suggestion would be that you may wish to organize a campaign for the establishment of a Department of Last Resort, DLR.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure you'd get a lot of grassroots support, but you can count on me to push for a Bureau of Nonsense Mail, BNM, within the new department. Sincerely, Gail L. Lively, Director, Executive Secretariat.
You can't fool those people sometimes, you know? That's just too short.
Well, our pizza's coming, and
it is.
All sorts
it's
of good things.
Be here in about a minute, so we're going to have to go into a tune.
Right.
25 minutes after 2 o'clock.
We got plenty of good stuff coming up in around 3 o'clock.
We are. Rob Zeiser's coming in at 3. We're going to try to get through to West Germany.
Right, and we also have a...
Find out a zoo.
We have some sports news, too.
Yes, we have a guest, in fact, and we'll be getting to that as quickly as we possibly can.
Oh,
We're back again, and we have a special guest.
Hello.
With us now is Mr. Charles DeBongo. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, it is.
And where are you from?
Well, I'm from Walla Walla, Washington, Eric.
Oh. You know, I've always wanted to meet somebody who came from there.
Well, now you have.
Yes. Well, you are in charge of a brand-new sports league that I don't think too many people have heard of. Now, I know I never heard about it until today.
That's precisely why I came to you, folks. I know you're always willing to give the underdog a chance. Well, here I am.
Yeah, well, you're the president and founding father of the North American Basketball Association, a fledgling organization.
That's right. Well, the concept first came into my head at a cocktail party in early May.
Mm-hmm.
And then in mid-July, I suddenly remembered it.
Oh.
And at that point, I made a few phone calls, arranged a couple of deals, and before I knew it, I had a brand new professional basketball league.
Well, things seem to have moved pretty fast for you, but how come nobody's heard of your organization?
Well, mainly because my secretary's a dumb clod and she forgets to put stamps on the press releases.
Mm.
Oh, well, that set us back quite a bit. Other than that, though, we've received quite a bit of flack from sports statisticians who don't really like the prospect of having to keep records for all these new teams.
And how many teams are in the NABA?
Well, we have 56 franchises at last count, Eric.
That's pretty darn good for a new organization. How did you manage to get so many together?
Well, you see, there are a lot of untapped markets that we happen to stumble across.
Oh?
Yeah, places like Abilene, Texas, San Joaquin, California, Chester, Pennsylvania, a lot of good talent in Chester, Macon, Georgia, and Orono, Maine. They just had great interest in basketball, but there just wasn't any team they could support. Now, through the miracle of telephones and interstate buses, that need is being served.
Oh, that's real gratifying to hear. Now, I know one of the reasons the other big leagues passed up the towns you mentioned is because there really isn't any place large enough for the teams to play in.
Oh, that's not true. That's not true at all, Eric. I'm afraid the NBA has been feeding you all sorts of biased propaganda. There's always a place for a major basketball team. In fact, we saved a heck of a lot of money by passing up towns with big coliseums.
Oh?
Yeah. Our Sloatsburg, New York team plays in the high school gym. We had 45 people down there the other night.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah. Now, the team in Gainesville, Florida plays on the lawn of their city hall, although I understand their mayor wants them to play in the street. And our Lubbock team, Lubbock, Texas.
Oh.
Home of Buddy Holly.
Oh.
Yes. Manages quite well inside the garage of their second string center.
I see. Well, maybe you'd like to tell the folks about the way the season operates.
Oh, I'd be glad to. We're kind of unique in that. Now, the regular season consists of a total of 4 games.
40?
No, 4.
4?
Yes.
You only play 4 games in the entire season?
Well, let me finish. Now, these 4 games determine the standing of the teams in the playoffs, which run from November to the end of August, which is right when our preseason games begin.
So the vast majority of your season consists of playoff games, is that right?
That's absolutely correct, Eric. And we have a rather unique system, too.
And what's that?
Well, we have 16 divisions, Northeast, Midwest, Southern Plains, and so on.
Yeah.
Well, in England, they have 4 divisions, that is, in soccer, but they call it football. Do you follow?
I think I do.
And at the end of their season, the bottom few teams of each division get put into a different division.
Uh-huh.
What we do is kind of similar. We take the bottom team of each division and ship it to another division on the other side of the country. Now, for instance, if Santa Barbara doesn't play good basketball, they could very well find themselves playing in Dover, Delaware next season.
Hmm.
And the only way they can get back to Santa Barbara is if they finish in the top third of their new division.
So a team could find itself away from home for an entire year.
That's right. And we don't have to pay for living expenses. So it's to everybody's advantage to play good.
One more question I'd like to ask you.
Sure.
Mr. DeBongo.
Yeah.
You
can call me Charles.
Thank you.
You can really call me Charlie. I've known you for 5 minutes.
Well, Charlie, where did you get enough talent to fill so many basketball teams out of the clear blue sky?
Well, there's a little secret to that, Eric. Start young.
Uh-huh.
The average age of our players is 9.7 years old.
You mean your teams consist of little kids who aren't even 10 years old yet?
Mm.
And you actually threaten to take them away from their hometowns if they don't perform up to par?
Little kids?
Well, look at it. Think of it this way, Eric.
They're playing for an entire year.
Right now, we're not all that well known, but in about another 10 years, all these kids will be bigger and they'll be playing better, too.
What makes you think they'll still be with your league?
Oh, they have to. They've all signed lifetime contracts.
We've been talking with Charles DeBongo, founder of the New North American Basketball Association, and perhaps a leader of the closest thing to child slavery we'll ever see in this generation.
Now, hold on a minute.
I'm going to report you to every agency I know of. What is this?
Thank you.
pour sa vie. Et le monde. Vieux. Et le monde.
Rondo the Bongo.
Yeah.
It's off of an album called Gone Clear, Reggae Makossa.
And before that.
Now, how would you pronounce that word?
Afrique. Afrique. A-F-R-I-Q-U-E. Afrique.
Okay, I'm just checking. That's probably how I'd pronounce it, too. Soul Makossa, written by Mano Dabongo. Is that any way related to Charles Dabongo?
I don't know. I think that's a coincidence.
Uh-huh. In any event, Mano Dabongo is not on this Soul Makossa LP.
Yeah.
Got something here to read. What's being described as a guerrilla war has erupted at the Voice of America. Interesting name, don't you think? Sparked by what many longtime employees feel are administration attempts to undermine their journalistic integrity. The final straw for many was the last week of a memo. The final straw for many was the leak last week of a memo urging the VOA to become a propaganda agency. The memo, written by VOA commentary coordinator Philip Nicolades before his appointment by the Reagan administration, also says we must portray the Soviet Union as the last great predatory empire on Earth, ever seeking by all means from subversion to military intervention to widen the areas it subjugates. Publication of the memo brought a strong outcry from agency employees who point out that the Voice is mandated by Congress to provide accurate, objective, and comprehensive news coverage. They are also upset by a reported request by Charles Wick, head of the United States International Communications Agency, to develop evidence that European anti-nuclear demonstrations are communist-inspired.
Oh.
Wick, whose previous experience includes producing the film Snow White and the Three Stooges, has also angered staffers by implying that they are projecting an unfavorable picture of the United States. Wick, a close personal friend of President Reagan, has admittedly denied any plans to disseminate propaganda and insists that his agency will report only demonstrable truths.
How about that?
How about that?
Sorry, you won't hear propaganda of that sort in the Voice of Long Island. You'll hear all sorts of other propaganda.
Yes, like something you have in that
book. Like the story from Zodiac. The last-minute delay in the second flight of the space shuttle Columbia may have disappointed many Americans, but in Detroit, last week's first attempt went off without a hitch. As the Detroit News told some of its readers, Columbia thundered to life on a flawless schedule and rode a plume of white-hot flame into partly cloudy skies. Of course, it happened that way only in the mind of the news reporter who filed an advance story for the edition, which hit the streets at about the planned liftoff time. When NASA's computer stopped the countdown, several thousand copies of the paper had already been printed, and although workers scrambled to collect them, at least 300 of the collector's items wound up at newsstands.
Golly.
That's really something. That's pretty funny when things like that happen.
I think so.
You can't do that on radio.
Sure you can.
Well, you can just mess up, but you can't do something that involves a time factor. It either happens or it doesn't.
Right.
You can't print something in advance.
Right.
You can't say something in advance because what you say is now.
Right.
Like you just said that.
No, I said that 5 minutes ago.
Exactly. I have another letter here.
Oh, from Randy Cohen.
From Randy Cohen. And this is a good one. This is to Mayor Edward Koch. And, of course, Ed Koch always writes back. Because I wrote to him once and he wrote back.
Personally?
Yeah. He always writes back personally. He believes in doing things like that. And this is a great letter that Randy Cohen wrote to Mayor Koch. Dear Mayor Koch, I love it when you say, how am I doing? I think you're doing just fine, particularly now that you've proposed a gambling casino for each of the five boroughs. This plan not only acknowledges that people like to gamble, but it shows a brave and inventive approach to seeking out new sources of revenue for our city. Sensing these qualities in you, I would like to submit another plan that also takes the measure of the people's desires and exploits an untapped source of revenue for the city. There has been much talk about legalized prostitution, notably the idea of creating a sort of red light district. However, no one wants such a district in his neighborhood. Thus, I propose legalized prostitution on buses and trains. This plan would create a mobile red light district, and as such, it would not be in anyone's neighborhood.
Furthermore, the plan would not allow the oldest profession on all routes, but only on commuter lines. This would encourage commuters to leave their cars at home in favor of mass transit. Thus, in one bold move, we could solve the prostitution problem, releasing police for more urgent duties. We would cut down auto pollution, reduce traffic congestion, and perhaps most important, raise new revenue for New York. At least that's the way I see it. What's your opinion? Yours, Randy Cohen.
What is Edward Koch's opinion?
Dear Ms. Cohen, I don't know how he got the idea that, Mr. Cohen was a Ms., but dear Ms. Cohen, I guess because he signed it Randy, and Mayor Koch really didn't know if it was a man or a woman, so he assumed it was a woman. I have your recent letter in which you suggest legalizing prostitution on buses and trains. Your plan to create a mobile red light district is, to say the least, original. However, the entire matter of legalizing prostitution is one which deserves serious consideration by government and, most importantly, by the people. Indeed, in a pluralistic society, all are entitled to different feelings on different subjects. I do appreciate your taking the time to write. All the best. Sincerely, Edward I. Koch.
Very interesting.
It certainly is.
Very interesting.
We should try doing things like that.
Well,
so we do it more with phone calls.
Yes, we do. So how about if we try calling up Germany?
You want to call Germany?
Sure.
All right, let's call Germany, and you want to pick a city over there that you'd like to find a zoo for?
Frankfurt.
Is that in Western? Yeah, I think you could do that.
Could we? Or how about München?
About what?
Munich.
Oh, you said München, like in Germany. Okay, I understand that.
Yeah. Jerry, did you know what Jerry DeLisle did to me last night?
What did he do?
He coughed all over the windscreen on this microphone, and he publicly apologized before at the beginning of his show, saying, "I apologize to Mike Uhas." Were you there for that?
I heard something like that.
That's because he was in a bad state of mental health. So what do you say, Munich in Germany, okay?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
And let's get on our way. Overseas we go.
We're going to try for the zoo?
Yeah, the zoo in Frankfurt, West Germany.
Munich.
Oh, Munich, okay.
It's a loud ring. Don't you think?
I think so. Intimidating.
Morning, Miss Space. May I help you?
Yes, good morning, operator. I need international information, please.
Where are you calling?
I'd like to call Munich.
All right, hold on. That's West Germany?
Yes.
And I'll connect you with the operator there. When you get your information, you can flash your receiver. I'll come back on and connect you to your number, okay?
Well, actually, I don't need to make this phone call right now.
I see.
It'll be a little bit later on in the morning, but I do need to know the number.
All right, hold on a moment.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're lying through your teeth and you know it. A German ring.
All right, hold on for the operator.
Thank you. Very clear ring, considering it's coming from all the way across the sea.
And that's a loud ring, too. But supposedly at the other end of the receiver is a very nasty German operator who another operator told us about last week. Huh.
Information?
Yes, hello, operator. I just need the number of the city zoo.
Tell me where you want something.
Pardon me?
Well, I can't know where you want something, sir.
Yes, I need to know in Munich.
In Munich? Okay, what is it?
The number of the city zoo, please.
Oh, one moment.
Thank you.
Okay.
What's the weather like over there, operator?
Funny.
Oh, Bob.
Oh, I guess you didn't hear me. Oh, boy.
It's good they have fun on their jobs.
No.
She's supposed to be nasty.
No idea.
Maybe we have to antagonize her. No, that's not like our nature. Looking for the city zoo of Munich. In Munich.
Oh, God. So do we just start something? So do we just
speak at
university?
A funny language. Sounds like she's talking backwards. We should try Reykjavik Zoo in Iceland.
Yeah,
what kind of animals would they keep there? Cold ones.
Cold animals.
It'd be nice if they paid attention.
This is the kind of conversation I hear between my dentist and his nurse all the time. They're always talking about something different. Never about my teeth.
Hope she didn't forget about us.
Number 661021.
661021. Okay, thank you very much.
By the way,
what's the weather like there this morning? Or today? What is the weather?
It's very windy and not raining.
Very windy and not raining. Okay, well, thank you very much. Goodbye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, you got your number, sir?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Thank you very much, operator.
Welcome.
All right. Well, we finally found an overseas zoo. We found one in, Spokane, Washington last week?
Yeah, but that's not really overseas.
That's not overseas.
That's over Great Lakes.
We have done something. We have a zoo now. We have a zoo in Munich.
Munich.
And I guess that makes sense. There should be a zoo in Munich.
Yeah, there should be.
Do you really want to try Reykjavik? I can't even say that.
Reykjavik in Iceland?
Reykjavik, Iceland. Do we have enough time? We only have 4 minutes. Do you want to make it quick?
Okay.
Let's do it quickly. But this is really almost entirely too silly for even us.
This theme song is getting too silly. I'm
trying to forget the same opera.
It would be, wouldn't it?
My name is Tennis. Can I help you?
Yes, operator. We need international information, please.
What country?
Iceland.
Okay, 1 moment.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ooh. Is that really in Iceland?
International operator 1066, what country are you calling?
We're trying to get through to... I need information in Iceland, actually.
Okay, what's the number you're calling from?
Area code 516-246-7901.
What's the name that the phone in Iceland is listed under?
Actually, we're looking for the Reykjavik City Zoo.
Hold on, please.
Thank you, operator.
You're welcome.
Operators can be so helpful.
Didn't whitewash that one, though.
Yeah.
Oh,
there's an Iceland room if I've ever heard one.
Reykjavik.
Yes, operator, I need to know the number, the number in Reykjavik of the city zoo.
Just a moment.
For the Reykjavik?
City zoo.
City zoo?
Yeah, the zoo, you know, where they keep the animals.
Yes, and I know, well, we don't have any zoo in Reykjavik. 1 moment.
Oh.
1 moment.
Thank you. I realize this is somewhat of an odd request at 3 o'clock in the morning, but...
Well, it's almost 8 o'clock in the morning there, though.
Oh.
Well, that's good.
At least we're not waking them up. Are we waking you up, by the way?
Oh, never.
Keeping you on your toes, I hope.
Woody, you have to work a night shift, huh? That's pretty rough.
No, it's rather easy.
Really?
Fewer chiefs, more Indians.
That's pretty nice. That's one way of looking at it, I guess. So now she's looking for the number, is she? Or
yes, but I don't believe there is a Reykjavik City Zoo.
Oh. Well, it can't hurt to try. See, I'm doing some research on some primordial mammals found only in the Icelandic areas. And I was hoping if they had a zoo or some kind of biological institute.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, we got one, but it's not. It's a bit out of Reykjavik.
Oh.
It must be the one. It's the only one in Iceland.
Okay. What is that number?
The number is 5-0-0-0.
And what is it? A Reykjavik area code?
Yes.
Thank you.
What city is it in?
Could you tell us what city it is in?
Well, it's not actually in a city.
Yeah. No, it's a bit out of Reykjavik, but it's a Reykjavik number, you see.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, so that number was 5-0-0-0?
That's correct, sir. Would you like me to connect you?
No, not at this time, though. Maybe a little bit later on, though.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome. Have a good morning.
And you too.
Bye.
Bye. Well, well, well.
Well, there you have it.
We're hot, Mike. I mean, we got through to...
Well, we can't be that hot because it's time for Rob Zeiser's show.
That's true, but we were getting through to a lot of zoos. I bet if we started now, we get all sorts of different zoos all over the place.
I don't think Rob likes it.
How about next week, Asia, huh?
Asian zoos.
Asian zoos.
Okay, well, either that or the local transit information hotline.
If anybody out there has any suggestions as to what zoo we should try for next week, give us a call. We'll be here for a little while after the show.
You heard us, the number. It's 246-7901. Area code?
516. We are the Voice of Long Island. We were the Voice of Long Island.
And you tuned to
WUSB in
Stony
Brook,
New York.
Oh, you took one there.
11794.
Good, very
and
good.
I'm Mike Uhas. I'll be back again next Thursday evening, 9 to 12.
And I'm Eric Corley. I'll be back again next Tuesday evening, right after Bandstand, 10 to 12, Long Island Bandstand, that is. And we'll both be back
On the Voice of Long Island next Friday night at midnight, or actually Saturday morning.
Or whatever, 12:02 a.m. to 3.
Good night. We'll see you then.
Rob Zeiser is next.
It's 8 a.m. Out my head by 10:30. Out with mates and dates and friends. That's what I do at weekends. I can't talk and I can't walk, but I know where I'm going to go. I'm going to watch my money go at the local. Thank you.
Sizer here with you at USBFM. I have a mellow morning planned for me this morning. I'm going to start here with the Who, Quadrophenia here at WUSBFM.